have a quorum and call the meeting to order of the Higher Education Finance Committee. I'd like to begin by having someone move the minutes. Representative Carlson moves the minutes on Monday, April the 11th. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved. Senator Bill, we generally have a packed house. Today, there must be something else going on. We apologize.
No problem, Mr. Chair.
But,
can I move this bill, Mr. Chair?
You may do that.
I'd like to move House File 1697 for possible consideration in the honor of this bill, I assume.
That is correct.
Thank you very much.
Senator Bill, welcome.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to come before you today, and I'm going to bring you up to date on this project. It takes this is a finance item, but I think you need to know a little of the history of it as well, Mr. Chairman and members. This project has the possibility to propel Minnesota into the unknown reaches of scientific research, things that we have not discovered. Frankly, the scientists tell us that when they discover them, they're not sure what they'll do with them once they know what they are. So this is one of those kinds of projects. And members, when immigrants began mining raw material and raw iron ore up in the small town up in Sudan, Minnesota, they had little idea that they would lead the U.S. Into the Industrial Revolution, providing raw materials for wars and skyscrapers and appliances and cars and, of course, much more. It's for certain those early immigrants never imagined that their mine would be used as a state park for quite some time, and then as a neutrino detector laboratory. Now, that's really getting out there to Buck Rogers land, because they've got this big gun down in the Fermi lab down in Chicago, and they shoot neutrinos through the earth, and believe it or not, they are aimed at the Tower Sudan mine, and they're captured at 2,500 feet below the surface. And then they are, they figure out how many, they figure out something about something. I'm not sure that they know what that is yet. But frankly, neutrinos are all around us, they tell me. They're in this room right now and passing through our body, and it's some more Buck Rogers business. But it's a huge opportunity that currently exists in the Tower Sudan mine up in northeastern Minnesota. And now today, members, the National Science...
Mr. Chairman, we were talking about it before you started. Is that the deepest mine in the U.S. or the world or something?
No, it is not.
It's not.
Actually, at 2,400 feet, there are quite a few mines that are that deep. There's a mine that we'll be talking about momentarily in South Dakota that's 9,000 feet below surface.
So much for my trivia.
Okay.
Well, maybe the deepest in Minnesota or something.
It is impressive, even though it's only 2,400 feet. And members, now the National Science Foundation has proposed to establish a deep underground science experiment laboratory. We'll call it for short DUSL. As deep as 9,000 feet below the Earth's surface. The project, when established, will conduct experiments and studies in cold matter research, geophysical studies, and geomicrobiology. So, if you're into that kind of stuff, you'll know what they're looking for. The project is estimated to cost over $1 billion over the next 30 years to construct and outfit the laboratory. And economically, members, this would be a great thing for our area, for Minnesota and northeast Minnesota, because it will likely establish 150 to 200 term, long-term, high-technology jobs. Presently, Minnesota is in an eight-way competition with seven other sites, six in the U.S. and one in Canada, for this coveted DUSL laboratory. A mine in South Dakota, Representative Carlson, has been a leading candidate for this DUSL project because it already is roughly 9,000 feet below the earth. However, that mine was a leading candidate, but that mine is a former gold mine and is owned by a company in Canada. And the mine is filled with water, and of course, in gold mining, you know, they use arsenic as a item to separate gold from the ore. And so the water has a variety of hazardous chemicals in the mine, and during the dewatering process, there would be environmental consequences, and since it's privately owned, the government of South Dakota, the state of South Dakota, isn't willing apparently to take on the responsibility, and the mine doesn't want to, the company doesn't want to dewater the mine, so it's kind of degrading their opportunity to compete for the Dussel project. The fact that Minnesota owns the Tower Sudan mine, and that the environmental consequences, of course, our mine has not been used for that. It was iron ore mining, and they're using it every day. People are going up and down on tours, and they have the neutrino project, and it's very unique in that Minnesota owns it, and this puts us in somewhat of a lead in competition. So this is how Minnesota fits the project. Sudan, the Sudan mine is being operated by the state, and in its bowels are the neutrino capturing equipment down to 2400, and as I said, it's kind of a Buck Rogers experiment on its own, and that's being conducted by the Department of Energy. So the mine currently at 2400 feet, and it's the mine, as I said, is at 2400 feet, and the university is presently in the application phase to the National Science Foundation, not the Department of Energy, but the National Science Foundation, for this project. And to enhance the final application to the Science Foundation, the people with all the money, the $1 billion, the university needs to investigate, and this is really the crux of why we're here to get the money. The university needs to drill down, if you can imagine the mine shaft going down and terminating. They need to go from that 2,400 feet level down to about 9,000 feet with a core drill and see what's down there. And the reason they need to do that is to determine if, in fact, the earth composition below the existing shaft is adequate to support this Dussel laboratory down at that 9,000 foot level. And that information that they will get from this drilling will be a key part of the application they'll send into the National Science Foundation to support the premise that this is the location for this very expensive laboratory. So as I said, the $250,000 request in this bill for the drilling, and this is probably the part that is this committee's keenest interest, is it will come from the Permanent University Fund, as we are proposing it would come from the Permanent University Fund. The request would have no fiscal impact on the state's budget or the general fund. And let me just share with you for a few moments, for those of you who aren't aware of the PUF or know much about the PUF. The PUF Fund, Permanent University Fund, back in 1851 and later in 1857, the federal government granted 144 sections of land to the state of Minnesota to support the university as the state's first land-grant university. And since then, the land presently calculated is 25,891 acres of raw land and 20,988 of minerals rights that are owned by the university and are managed in the PUF account, the Permanent University Fund Land Trust. And they've been managed, they're managed by DNR, the PUF funds, and the money from the from things like iron mining leases, road easements, utility leases, logging of iron ore, I mean logging of pulpwood, and activities like that across the Iron Range and across the state are where the money comes from. The PUF money benefits the university in three ways. It endows chairs in various academic disciplines. There is an endowment for the minerals, for further minerals research at the national, at the NRRI up in Duluth and in Coleraine. And lastly, it endows incoming freshman University of Minnesota scholarships. And in 2004, this money paid for about 1,150 scholarships at the university to incoming freshmen. At the end of 2004, members, there was $314.8 million in the Permanent University Fund. So as you can see, the royalties add up to a lot of money over the years. The $250 in this project, as proposed, would be redirected from the revenue stream flowing to the NRRI Minerals Research Account. Now, the NRRI, their research account from the current stream is capped at $25 million. And they are approaching that cap, and it's expected that that cap will occur in about 2006. So this is a very small diversion of the millions of dollars going to the research of minerals. And one of the reasons that we believe that this is appropriate, that this is appropriation is appropriate, is because the Tower Sudan mine site members is on trust land. Trust land that has generated since the early 1900s money for the PUF, for the Permanent University Fund, from mining royalties, actually starting back in about 1991 or so. So we think that it's an appropriate thing to do. It's an appropriate use. The university supports the continued quest to locate the Dussel project at the Tower Sudan mine site. And members, I just want to close in saying this is an incredible opportunity for Minnesota. This is pretty cutting-edge stuff. As I said, the scientists have no idea what they're going to do with what they find out, but it'll probably use for something that we hope will be good. So this is a chance to give this project a boost, located in Minnesota, enhance an economy, and look into the unknown for future generations. And with that, I will stand for questions.
Representative Carlson.
I just have a what-if question. I noticed the language says we're appropriating it for that specific purpose, and hopefully the bill will be enacted and we'll get the grant. My question is, what if we don't get the grant? What happens to the $250 then? Does it revert back to the PUF account, or...
Being
it's there for a specific purpose, mm-hmm. would it take legislative action to return it, or does it automatically go back? And unfortunately, I really was going to maybe address that to Mr. Berg, but maybe Representative Hill knows the answer.
No, actually, I don't know the answer to that, and I think that if, thinking this just very quickly through, that if the drilling did not occur because it's specifically appropriated for that, then it should be returned to the minerals account that is dedicated to NRI. Never our intention, of course, to hurt the any of these scholarships or the chair endowments or any of that. And so I think that it should be returned to the NRI account. Of course, they're capping out very quickly. 2006, they'll be capped out. By the way, members, when the NRI account, there's three streams. One goes to the endowment of chairs, one goes to the NRI to $25 million cap, and then all of the rest of the money goes over to the scholarship account. And once the NRI reaches its cap of $25 million, then all the money from that point goes to the scholarship accounts. So somehow we could figure out how to make a mid-course correction here and fix that.
John, I don't mean to make it an issue. That's
a good point.
Curious what happens when it's... Because we actually have appropriated. We didn't say it was available for or something like that, but that may not work the best either, so... Hopefully we get the grant, and it's not even a question we have to worry about. Thank you.
Well, I'd be willing, of course, to work that out with the chair as this moves forward and find out the answer to that question.
You'd indicated a grant application to the federal government?
To the National Science Foundation. That's correct. Okay. And they receive, of course, Mr. Chairman, probably a lot of their money from the federal government.
Any idea how long that'll take?
The first application, Mr. Chair, has already been turned in. There are actually three applications that are... What will happen, Mr. Chair, is that the first application was turned in on February 28th, and that's when all of the sites, like seven or eight sites, have been turning in applications. Then there will be a cut made, and the cut will come with the surviving applicants will receive money from the National Science Foundation to do additional research to support the next level of application. And with that money and with our money, with the PUF money, they will be able to complete that application, and then there will be down to two, as I understand. And the third application will be a head-on-head application against whomever the remaining two are.
So is there a time?
A couple of years.
I'm just guessing or suggesting that if this doesn't happen this year, we'd have an opportunity to continue to work on it next year without jeopardizing anything?
Well, Mr. Chair, the critical nature of this particular proposal is that in order for us to compete and really compete appropriately in the second round, assuming we make the cut on February 28th, which we should know relatively soon, and we certainly think we will because we think we're the top candidate in the whole United States and Canada as well, then we need that money in this very near term, soon, this year, so that we can compete in the second round. And so the answer to your question is actually it's the timeliness of this is quite important.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Berg came back and he gave me the answer to the question, but if it's all right before we vote on it, if he would give the answer.
We're going to be laying this over.
Yeah, so, but in terms of where the money goes, if we didn't get the grant, and he has the answer to that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, my understanding is that since existing statute controls how PUP funds are appropriated to the U, this bill, notwithstanding that section, appropriates it for a specific other purpose. If that purpose is not met, existing statute controls the money, so it would just go as it does. If the bill is passed and the project does not go forward,
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman. That would what we just discussed is what would happen, and that's good.
Just had a thought. Any chance of hitting oil while you're doing this?
Well, Mr. Chairman, you know, there's up at just very near the site is incredible amounts of precious metals. Gold, palladium, platinum, very near that. And so maybe we'd get real lucky.
Any additional questions?
Mr. Chairman, Donna Peterson, University of Minnesota. I just want to clarify. As I understand it, this $250,000 will be used to do testing. And so, therefore, it will be spent prior to the knowledge of knowing the final outcome of getting the grant. This is information they need that they believe will assist them in getting the grant.
And Mr. Chairman, I think, I'm sorry.
I think the committee would be sort of interested in the position that the U has on this project. Can you share with us?
Mr. Chairman, for the project itself, we believe that this is it's a top-notch project. The scientists involved are top researchers at the University of Minnesota. We have tended to stay away from supporting any taking away from the monies that they go into the PUP accounts. We believe that those accounts were set up, and we like to see those endowments grow. But there have been several occasions where the legislature has decided to take a small amount before it reaches the endowment and use it for a project such as this. This minerals account will be full, as was stated, either this year or next year. Thereafter, all monies will go into the scholarship funds, and I think that so far there has been, the legislature has never chosen to change or divert any of the money going into the scholarship fund, so I would hope that that then prevails in the future.
Thank you. Mr. Berg has a...
And Mr. Chair, after Ms. Peterson's comments, I would clarify, when I said the project, I meant the core sampling borehole.
Right.
Were that not to be drilled, that is, were the 250 not to be used, it would go back. I did not mean if we were not successful in our grant, that this money would be prepared because it would already be spent, as Ms. Peterson.
Yeah, I would, Ms. Chair, I think I follow that in that we're talking about a $250,000 grant of this, in essence, for this particular small piece of the project, and there might have been confusion about the building of the laboratory.
Correct.
Yeah.
Perhaps covers it. Just again, see an observation here in your article that they're going to have some circular ramps. Goes on to say for easy access to all levels.
Yeah, I can
just imagine
talk about
my
that.
Little four-cylinder car trying to make that.
Actually, Mr. Chairman, I guess I can give you some additional information on that. This is a massive project. There will be 400-500 laborers working on this for quite some number of years. And they are going to build a spiral staircase. Everyone knows what that looks like. Large enough to drive a semi-tractor trailer loaded down to 9,000 feet, as I understand it. And then they are going to build a slant shaft from the surface for big enough for a truck to drive out of as a vent and escape shaft, as well as the original shaft that goes up presently, the 2,400-foot shaft. So, I mean, this is a huge undertaking. And this is something. And of course, Senator Bach and I are thrilled that it's going to be in our district, and it's going to be of a great benefit to us. And you know, this money is coming back to roost a little bit to help with something for the real future. I mean, but imagining a spiral staircase large enough to drive a tractor trailer loaded to 9,000 feet below the earth is something that I really don't have a grasp of the scale.
No, I can't. I don't think any of us can really visualize that.
Yeah, well, I can't, but somebody can, and there's people that know. So, yeah.
Representative Opence, would you like to renew
motion? Mr. Chair, I'll renew my motion that House File 1697 be held over for possible consideration in the omnibus bill.
Right, thank you, and
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We'll be done.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, Representative Cox. Should indicate to the members that are here that there's a card in your packet. Little advertising. Workshops taking place today and tomorrow, just for your information. Take part if you can. Representative Combs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move House File 1047 before you and for possible inclusion in your final omnibus bill.
You may proceed.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The bill here, House File 1047, deals with setting up a program to provide some additional funding to two programs that are, I think, important, the Talent Search and Upward Bound programs that are already in place as part of some of the federal government's work. And you should have some information before you, members, that outline some of this, the areas in the state, some of the that are currently participating in the talent search programs, including places like the Century College and College of St. Scholastica, Normandale and St. Wolf and so forth, and then also on the same list, the Upward Bound programs. So I'm not going to go through all those for you right at this minute, but there's quite a few spread around the state, and you also should have a map in there that indicates where some of these... So you can see geographically a little bit about where they are. Essentially, what the programs, both these programs are doing is trying to reach out to, I'm just going to call them non-traditional students, first-generation students, trying to make them aware of the value and importance of college and get them all settled in on a college career track as they're going through high school. This is a real concern of mine, and I think it should be everybody's, because the demographics are not necessarily working in our favor for continuing the well-prepared student that is ready and able to afford college and chomping at the bit and ready to go there. We're going to have to reach out to fill our future needs here in Minnesota and a whole lot of other states. We're going to have to reach out to some more non-traditional students that aren't necessarily in the college campuses today. And it isn't just, I think this is something that isn't just a college deal, too. I run a construction company, as many of you may know, and when I look, I've been doing this for 32 years, and when I look at my available labor pool, it has changed a lot since the time when I was 20 years old and got into this game. And I'm thinking those same kinds of things are happening in a lot of other businesses. I don't use college graduates so much, but for those businesses that do, this is going to become crucial to kind of provide this proper, well-trained workforce here. Mr. Chair, this bill was to be heard yesterday, and then, as we all know, things have a way of being fluid around here, and they changed. I had a number of testifiers that were here yesterday. I want to just go over a couple of them, and then I'll turn it over to Bruce Shelsky from the director of the TRIO programs here to talk a little bit about the bill. But I had a number of St. Olaf students. St. Olaf is a big participant in this program, in both the Upward Bound program and the Talent Search program. I had Lily Moore. She's a junior at St. Olaf, and she's studying sociology, anthropology, and management studies, and she participated in the education talent search program at Arlington High School in St. Paul. Real talented young lady. And I would also let the members know that Representative Norness was able to say hello to all these people, popped out in the, from the House floor and was able to at least see them so that he knows they were here and ready to come before you. I also have Vince Foster. He's a freshman at St. Olaf studying political science, and he participated in the Upward Bound program from Humboldt High School. And then Jonathan Pischler is another graduate of Humboldt High, and a junior at St. Olaf in the Upward Bound program. And Melissa Hinderscheid is a graduate of the talent search program through her high school program at Mankato State. And she also participated in the Upward Bound program through Century College and currently works for the TRIO program at St. Olaf. As I said, they have the Upward Bound and Talent Search program there, so they have a big component at St. Olaf. And then Mari Totovinto benefited from the Upward Bound program also at Humboldt High and attended and graduated from St. Cloud State. So those were some of the people that were here. And then we also have a member serving in the legislature, Representative Cy Tao. He's a co-author in this bill, and he participated at the University of Minnesota in the TRIO programs there. So there's probably others that I may not be aware of, but these people were ready to talk about it a little bit. And if it's all right, Mr. Chair, I would turn it over to Bruce Shelsky, the director of TRIO, and he can tell you a little bit more.
Morning, and good to see you again.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Okay. My name is Bruce Shelsky. I direct the TRIO Student Support Services College Retention Program at the University of Minnesota General College. To thank the chairman and the representatives for this opportunity. My role yesterday was to provide a brief overview of the types of services that the programs conduct and then get out of the way for the other people to testify. Before I give some details about educational talent search and Upward Bound, I want to emphasize that both programs work in close partnership with their host schools and would not be successful without the full cooperation of the schools. Upward Bound staff and educational talent search staff work directly with school teachers, counselors, and administrators to set up offices, identify students, monitor student progress, and intervene to provide joint intervention services. Well, higher education institutions are awarded the federal grants, most of the work takes place in the schools, and the students are the ones that benefit. The schools recognize this and commit space and time, staff time, phone, and supplies to the projects. Talent search programs have operated in Minnesota since 1982. There are currently 7 projects serving 5,600 students annually. In 2004, we received about $2.1 million in federal funds. Each talent search project serves between 600 to 1,000 students. Talent search serves students in middle schools as well as high schools. And in most of these schools, talent search staff are on site 3 or 4 days a week, so there's a continuity of services to students and an opportunity to interact with school staff. I can't emphasize enough the importance of having the trust of the public school sites. The schools have a healthy skepticism when people from higher education show up and say, "Hi, I'm from college, I'm here to help." And I think the educational talent search programs and Upward Bound programs, by the length of their service in the schools, have become sort of part and parcel of the programming that goes on to help students. The following services are provided by both talent search and Upward Bound. Financial aid, information, and assistance. This is extraordinarily important because many students and parents do not know what's available to fund higher education. The Minnesota Higher Education Services Office and the Wilder Foundation have done numerous studies that indicate, particularly with low-income parents, they often overestimate the cost of attendance, sometimes believing that college costs as much as twice as what it truly does, and they underestimate the availability of student financial aid, sometimes estimating as low as half of what is truly available. So a dampening effect on students' aspirations for college. Programs provide academic and personal advising, assistance in enrolling in college prep and technical prep curriculums, college entrance examination, basic standards, test prep and practice, cultural and student leadership and service activities, and referrals to community and school resources. A very important service is to provide goal exploration and decision making, helping students look at different careers, narrow down choices, determining which colleges and technical college and program would best help them to reach their career goal. In the retention literature, for a student to have a clear purpose and goal for why they're attending college or technical college is a very important factor in whether or not that student will persist to graduate. And quite honestly, students have very limited exposure to potential careers. They get most of their information from TV, and the number of crime scene investigators that are showing up at college campuses is pretty enormous. The programs provide post-secondary information, enrollment assistance, they provide college tours, assistance in completing applications, and referrals to college support programs. That's important because when a student arrives on campus, you want somebody sort of waiting, you know, there for them and looking out for them. I think one of the things that happens that's very important is that these programs leverage the federal and hopefully state dollars that are provided to them. So, for example, St. Olaf Educational Talent Search Program runs a mentoring program, and they work with 200 volunteer college students who then in turn mentor 400 middle school and ninth grade students at Minneapolis, Washburn and North High Schools, Northeast Junior High, and St. Paul Humboldt Senior and Middle School. The professional staff identify the mentors, train them, match them with mentees, monitor the relationships, schedule events, provide transportation. But it greatly amplifies the effect of the support that the programs receive. During the 2003-2004 school year, 88% of all college-ready seniors served by Minnesota Talent Search programs enrolled in post-secondary education. Give you an idea how that compares, an institutional researcher, higher ed researcher named Tom Mortensen, looking at Minnesota, took a look at ninth graders who received free and reduced lunch while they were in high school, and then found out what percentage of students received Pell Grants up to 6 years later when they would become, excuse me, 4 years later when they become college students. What he found in Minnesota, about 30% of low-income students participate in higher education by the time they're 19. That's compared with about 53% of all Minnesotans, and that's compared with this 88% number from Educational Talent Search. Upward Bound is the more comprehensive and extensive of the two programs. Upward Bound projects have operated in Minnesota since 1966. Currently, there are 18 projects serving roughly 1,300 students. In 2004, the programs combined received about $6.5 million from the federal government. Last year, 81% of the Upward Bound students were both low-income and first-generation students, 61% were students of color. Each Upward Bound project serves between 60 and 100 students. Students are identified in the ninth grade and remain in projects through high school. Services include the common advising services that I mentioned with Educational Talent Search, plus a very strong instructional component. All Upward Bound students participate in after-school and Saturday academic classes on college campuses, six-week summer intensive program, it's like summer school and summer camp, and if it's on a residential campus, that can be a residential program where the students live in dormitories. Again, with outcomes, of all the ninth grade students who entered Upward Bound projects during the 1997 to 2000 school years, 84% graduated with their class and 71% enrolled in post-secondary education. The largest concentration of Upward Bound programs actually serves the Minneapolis and St. Paul schools, and we need to remember there that the four-year graduation rate for those schools hovers in the 50% range. Another area that these programs focus on are parental involvement. Talent Search and Upward Bound programs acknowledge that one of the major keys to student success is to get parents involved in their children's education. The programs actively encourage parents to participate in project activities, serve on project advisory boards, and meet with project staff on a regular basis. I heard Upward Bound staff sort of discussing this in a collegiate forum and said, essentially, we end up stalking those parents. Because, again, the context in which these programs operate, the Minneapolis schools have done surveys 25% of the parents of Minneapolis school children never participate in school parent conferences, and 36% seldom. So getting the parent involvement is a critical issue. Staff in these programs are professionals, all have bachelor's degrees, and many have advanced degrees. They receive training from their host college and through the state, regional, and national TRIO professional associations. Staff from TRIO projects serve on a number of school and community committees, boards, and organizations, such as the Minnesota Minority Education Partnership and the Alan Page and Rebecca Wallen Scholarship Foundations, where they reach out to promote success for all disadvantaged students. One of the most important things about all TRIO programs is that they have a culture of accountability. Every 4 years, projects must submit a proposal for funding to the U.S. Department of Education. In the proposal, projects must state measurable outcome objectives that they will achieve each year, the procedures they will use to meet these objectives, and how they will evaluate the program. You have to report on those objectives annually, and if the objectives are not reached, the department may withhold funds or, in extreme cases, close the project. And I'm happy to say that has never happened in Minnesota. I think the other thing that's unique about the TRIO network is that we represent all the higher education systems in Minnesota, plus the Minnesota Chippewa Tribe. We have programs at 2- and 4-year public and private colleges in Dakota and St. Cloud Technical Schools. So we come from separate agencies or separate systems, but we function as a team on the ground. The programs are open and have information, share information to show that we're successful. I was hoping to be able to introduce Representative Cy Tao. I've known Cy since he was a ninth grader at Minneapolis North High School. And in a bit of serendipity over at the university's spring break, we were told we had to go through our archives. We had taken up too much filing space in our at our campus. And so in throwing away and recycling these things, I came across the stacks of weekly evaluations that the Upper Bound students do during the summer academic camp. And, you know, one of the questions is, what could we do to improve Upward Bound? And I found one that a student said, no curfew and less homework. So I sort of saved that one out, and I kept on going. And for the summer of 1989, I found another one that said, how can I improve this? We can improve this program. And said, no curfew, less homework. But there's also a question there, what's the most important thing that you learned during the past week? And what Cy had written is that in my active citizenship class, I learned I can make a difference in government. So I'd be glad to entertain questions.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate all the information there that Mr. Chelsky gave. The TRIO, for those of you who don't know, and some of us, I've been aware of the Upward Bound program component of the TRIO for some time, but TRIO really is a total of 7 programs that the federal government gets involved with, and this bill is dealing with 2 of them. But you should know that 2/3, by law, the federal law, 2/3 of the students served by these TRIO programs have to be right now coming from families with incomes less than $24,000 a year, and they have to not have a baccalaureate degree from their parents. So it really is reaching out to students that are not, you know, typically in showing up in our college classes today on their campuses. And the program will be administered by HESO. The additional funds that the bill is asking for, $5 million each year of the next biennium, would allow us to reach out to somewhere around 4,000 more students. And then if you look at that, this map that's in your packets, this is what I'm talking about the demographics are not working well here in the upper Midwest. When you look at the projections, we're dropping, but of course, ignore the Dakotas for a minute, but I mean, we're with Wisconsin, you know, we're doing, hanging in there on that, but these are significant drops, and we're going to have the needs for business and industry to have well-prepared employees in the pipeline coming in there. And I think this bill will allow us to generate some of those and that maybe are, for whatever reason, they're just not in a college mode. I think you all know that. If you're raised in a family, and from when you're 5 years old, you know, the first time you mentioned talking about going to college, you're just poo-pooed in ideas that that's too expensive, you can't go there. You know, we just got to get you out and get through high school, and they're focusing on getting through high school and getting you out there going to work. That after a while, that wears on you, and you now become in that mindset. And these programs really do allow great interaction with a variety of people to sort of rebuild that and let people know there is an option, and there's things that we can do to allow those students to be successful.
Representative Dempsey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Cox, why does that take place? What is there in families that's causing that? I mean, we're looking here at the projections of high school graduates, 26%, 10% in Minnesota, and you can go through them. Gracious me, what solutions can we propose to turn that around? Because I think it's vitally important that people that are in need of assistance, we don't want to lose those. I know when I got out of the military, I was allowed to have the GI Bill. Well, that was great, and I was able to use those funds in a productive manner. And I was just wondering, if we don't propose a solution, we're going to lose a lot of good kids. And I'm just wondering, what do we do in regard to that?
Representative Cox, I assume that that's just that's fewer kids. Isn't that what that represents?
This is fewer graduates, but I think there's two issues, Representative Dempsey, Mr. Chair. Our demographics of the state is changing a little bit here. Now, we got a lot of baby boomers. Folks my age, others are here in that same category, and I wasn't pointing at Mike. I was pointing at you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And we simply are having the change that's coming forward on that. But you may remember a few weeks ago I was here with another bill, the Dream Act bill, where we've got students that are in our K-12 schools right now. And the students that we're seeing here at this table, I think were ones that hopefully are going to be successful and they're going to move on into a higher education. But a lot of their friends, thinking that they simply can't do that, that's not in their reach, so they're going to give up. And they may not graduate, Representative Dempsey, they may not apply themselves to their whole ability, and you know, that's a real shame to not draw on that. But the other thing I think is that as people are out there talking about college, if you are not a college graduate and you have children, and you're not in the income earning stream where you can simply write a check to pay for them to go to college, it's a scary thing. And unless you connect with people to say, well, you know, we've got state grant programs, we've got Pell grants, we've got a whole lot of other things here now, so to take the scare away, that isn't to say you're not going to have to do some investing of yourself, but it becomes so scary for them that they just pretty much start pushing their child to not think about that because they're not maybe prepared to deal with it, essentially. I mean, not that they don't think it would help them, their child maybe have better earning potential and lift their life to a good position. It's just that they're not equipped and ready to deal with it. They didn't do with it themselves, and they're not there. These programs reach out to students like that have the ability, but maybe don't have the support systems in place from their family. It's a very difficult thing to try to deal with. If you, like I say, if you're going home every day after school, and you're being told that two things that are scary. Number one is that you just simply can't go. We don't have money. Only rich kids can do that. Forget that. And whoever was talking to you about it, don't talk to them anymore. And, you know, just kind of that attitude. The scarier one is if they tell you you're too dumb. You know, that you don't have the ability. And there are parents who will do that as an effort to try to again, put the brakes on the idea of college that, you know, I didn't go and I managed to buy the house and then you got a car and you've got clothes and that's really what you need to do. We don't have a whole lot of brains in our family kind of deal. And that's real scary.
Representative Dempsey.
Mr. Chairman, you brought up a point, Representative Cox, that is really true in our school that we had. We were kind of problem. We were a little avant-garde, to be honest with you, in dealing with kids. And one of the things that we did is, in most schools, they have an honor roll. Am I correct in that? Did the people around, people ever hear of an honor roll in their school? Okay. Huh? An honor roll only takes care of A and B students. And the slogan in our school was, is everybody is somebody. And we said, if everybody is somebody, what are we doing to that 80% of the kids that aren't on the honor roll? Mm-hmm. So what we did is we created the GROW program. Okay? Now, I'm not going to take a whole bunch of your time, but that was a program that enhanced the self-image of kids. Okay? That's what it was. And that was the lower 80% in the school that we had. Now, I haven't yet, but I'm thinking of possibly the first thing we did is one of the things that for everybody is somebody, you don't throw the kid out of school. So I got a piece of legislation that gives schools an option to having kids on out-of-school suspension. You know, we'll punish you, we'll get you out of school. That, I think that's counterproductive. So I got a piece of legislation in regard to that. I hope that gets passed. Problem is that then I'll have to tell them how to put the program into make it work, because that's not in the bill. But I can do that, and I'm willing to do that. Second thing is I think we should also have a program that recognizes that 80% of the kids on the bottom that aren't A and B students and aren't always recognized. And we got a program called a GROW program. Now, I'm going to take you how that is, because this is in secondary education. But that's another solution to the problem, that exactly what you're telling exists, and we're not proposing a solution. I got the solution, I'll be very honest with you. I'll tell you what we did in our school to make that work. And if everybody is somebody in your school, and you see to that that takes place. Mm-hmm. And so I might put that, whether or not that'll pass or not, I don't know, but it isn't done by any scientific research or anything. It's just done because in our school, we knew as administrators that that was a need that existed. Mm-hmm. And by gum, the program's still hanging in there, and we recognize those 80% of the kids as well. Anyhow, mm-hmm. So I'm what you said is really true, and I'm sorry I'm editorializing. Right. I didn't mean to do that.
We've got time. You talked about the federal funds. Any change in the federal funding? Or don't you know yet?
Well, yeah, there is potential, and Mr. Shelsky can probably hit that, but there is. Talking about potential reductions, I guess.
These programs have existed and have had bipartisan support since the Johnson Era Great Society programs. They were developed out of that era, the anti-poverty programs, the educational opportunity programs. But some of our strongest supporters have been Senator Domenici, for example, at the federal level. We've prospered under all administrations. This year, the president did eliminate Upward Bound and Educational Talent Search programs from his proposed budget. I'm pleased to say that the Senate budget reinserted those programs, and both senators from Minnesota signed on to that amendment to reestablish the Upward Bound Educational Talent Search programs in the federal budget. And currently, on the House side, there is a Dear Colleague letter to reinsert Upward Bound Educational Talent Search into the appropriations process on the U.S. House side. And thus far, five Minnesota representatives have signed on to that letter, including Representative Ramstead, and we have great hopes that we'll have a clean sweep. So this isn't the first time that the programs have been under attack, but we have large numbers of supporters. We have Republican Representative Henry Bonilla from San Antonio, as an alumni of the Educational Talent Search Program operated in San Antonio, and he sits on the House Secondary Education Committee. So we have our believers, and they are in communication with their decision makers.
Representative Carlson, you have a question?
Mr. Chair, I had a comment and then a question, but I was going back to the graduation rates, and I think there are probably two or three dynamics that are taking place relative to Minnesota. The Dakotas, as you referenced, they're having an overall decline in population. Iowa is there. I was listening to public radio the other day, and they're talking about tax forgiveness for young people to get them to stay in Iowa. So some of the issues are a little different in each of the states, but
I think North Dakota's cried that too, at least talked about it.
But if we look at, you know, the numbers in K-12 and what have you, that has changed. But I think what's relevant to this program is that if we look a few years ago, we were somewhere, and I was just sitting here trying to recall, Minnesota overall was like a 92 or maybe 93% graduation rate, if I recall correctly. And I read something a while back where we've slipped now to about 89%. Statewide, and I think that's what's relevant to this program, how we can turn that erosion, if you will, of our graduation rate around. Now, there are a couple of issues there as well. We've got, at least when I before I retired from teaching, we had growing numbers of students that were, for a variety of reasons, not necessarily graduating on time, and part of that may be when or how you're taking the picture. But at any rate, the goal of this program is to not only improve on the graduation rates, but post-secondary participation as well, and has been a good program. I did have a question that's one more of curiosity than anything else, because when I looked at the handout here, I noticed that we have a relationship with the University of Wisconsin, River Falls, and just curious how that interacts with the state of Minnesota. And by the way, for members of the committee that commented on this before, when I was still actively teaching, Wisconsin higher ed institutions were as active as Minnesota higher ed institutions in terms of our career days and being at the high school recruiting students and so on. So I'm not surprised to see them on the list, but on the funding side, how does that that work with a Wisconsin institution?
Representative Cox, can you just slide the mic over?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, in order to obtain a federal grant for an Upward Bound and Educational Talent Search Program, it's an extraordinarily competitive grant process. Grants are read by three independent federal readers. There's usually somewhere between three times as many grants submitted as there are funded. But a full 25% of the scoring that goes on has to do with whether or not the grant is able to establish a need for these kinds of intervention services, because as Representative Carlson was saying, there are two sets here. Total chance for college depends upon both graduation from high school and matriculation to college, and then we get into the retention issues. And so the University of Wisconsin River Falls is, it is the closest residential four-year state university to the city of St. Paul, because it's only 35 miles away from the border. So when they defined the target area and the target and developed a relationship with the schools that they wish to serve, they include rural Wisconsin areas, but they also included St. Paul Public Schools. And so that's why, and so they formed an agreement between the St. Paul Schools and the University of Wisconsin River Falls. So the River Falls staff come out to the schools and work during the academic year, and the students go to River Falls in the summer for the summer academic camp.
Representative Cox.
Mr. Chair, members, picking up on something Representative Dempsey said regarding, you know, what do you do about this, or how has it sort of happened where you have students that maybe have the ability to go to college that are not necessarily directed there. I think the, I don't want to blame our K-12 system, because I think they've changed and really done about as much as they can with their recruiting, I guess, so to speak. And Representative Carlson, I know you're old enough, Representative Norton, same as me, when the, we were a school, remember when there used to be college-bound and non-college-bound tracts? And when you're in a college-bound track, that was getting reinforced in you every day, that you were in the proper English class, you were in the proper math classes, and so forth, and you were channeled over into that, and they were kind of doing that. Well, we've got away from tracking people in high schools like this, so we're really, by doing that, and I'm not faulting the K-12s, but by doing that really opens things up a little bit, where it's all just a mix now, and we're relying on that somebody is talking to the students. I remember my own high school interested in construction wanted to take architectural drafting. I went to sign up for that, and the guidance counselors that were signing us up back in the late 60s for that would not accept that. They would not allow me to do that. That was in the vocational wing, and I was in the college track, and I had to end up bringing my mom out to the high school with me and meet with the principal. They were not going to accept that I was going to do this. I think that there was a real push to make sure that this pipeline was being fed with well-prepared students from the K-12 systems. And that's changed a little bit now, just from the demographics, the social makeup of our society and everything, so that these programs are very valuable programs, and I think they're absolutely essential to, again, keep that pipeline full of talented and qualified people.
Representative Cox, do you have any other testifiers?
I don't believe so. Is there somebody else that needs to say anything?
We
covered it all.
Okay. You know, okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Wanted to ask. Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to say that Mr. Shulsky, when you were talking about Representative Tao, I thought he would have been the one that would have wanted more, less curfew and a lot less homework.
Certainly was him, yes.
And we regret that he's not here today to help testify.
And Mr. Chair, members, he was sat yesterday also, and was going to be able to talk to me on the floor, and wondered if we were going to still fit it in and everything. So he was sure hoping to be here.
Well, Mr. Chair, I suspect that he's probably doing a lot of homework right now. I have a couple of questions and just a quick comment. I sat in on Mr. Chair on the Senate testimony. Not necessarily on the bill, but earlier in the year when they did a little bit about TRIO programs and other college access programs. And I know that Representative Cox and Mr. Shulsky had some folks yesterday lined up to do that. Unfortunately, the session took us out of orbit there. But it's too bad that we didn't get the chance to hear them, because at least what I heard in the Senate is it's really very compelling to hear current students and former students, and I appreciate Representative Dempsey's questions, because I think those students pretty quickly got to the heart of the matter about what a difference these programs did in their lives. These are, in many cases, students that clearly were quite capable of doing well in post-secondary, but probably would not have gone to post-secondary, or at least probably would not have gone right away. And whose options also might have been limited, but for the kind of involvement that they had in the programs. And they're just, just incredible stories. And I could tell you that in my own, my own life, this whole issue of, the family dynamic, it shouldn't be translated that, parents don't have aspirations. In fact, virtually, sort of the parental, tendency is to have aspirations for your kids. But I think Representative Cox has got it right, that the lack of knowledge about how things work and being afraid and many about the unknown has a lot to do with this. And I know my own dad was very fearful about me applying to schools further than a bike ride from from my house, and he actually refused to sign my application form. And it wasn't that he didn't want his kid to go to college. He was just it was scary. It was unknown. My dad had a wonderful person, a great family man, provided a great living for our family, working in a factory, but eighth grade education is as far as he got. And so anything beyond that was just a big mystery for him. And these programs really do help to break down that barrier. And I do think they make a real powerful difference. But I do have a couple of questions. So I'm a big fan of TRIO. Mm-hmm. And by the way, Mr. I should come clean, I'm also a TRIO, former TRIO student, not in these two programs, but in mm-hmm. the Student Support Service component, which mm-hmm. is the component for the students who are on post-secondary school mm-hmm. Campus and then receive some form of tutoring and mentoring to sort of continue to demystify, that experience. And I don't know if they were effective or not, Mr. Chair, because I wound up being a legislator. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. But I have a couple questions, just having to do with sort of the big picture here. There's $5 million in each year, so $10 million in the biennium in this request. Is the intent of these really good programs to use those funds to expand opportunities into more districts? And I'm looking, Mr. Chair, at the sheet, and it's actually pretty impressive. I mean, you've got Waseca, Wilmer, Reamer, Mankato, Rochester, Red Wing, as well as many urban core Twin City high schools involved, so it's a pretty good spread around the state. I know that there are gaps around the state. I was in St. Peter this summer visiting a different program down there, and they told me, Mr. Chair, that in rural parts of surrounding St. Peter there, that the demand is just incredible. Kids are really hungry, and parents are, for these kind of programs. So the first question is, is it is the intent to expand into more districts with the additional, with the state support, or is it to expand to cover more students within the existing districts, because even there's a whole bunch of students that aren't able to participate, or is it both?
Representative Cox.
Representative Miami, Mr. Chair, really it's expanding the existing programs. That are in place, and I think the feeling there is that the funds will get the biggest bang for our buck, I guess, so to speak, because we're not going to be running additional administrative and startup costs and some of that. That isn't to say that there maybe wouldn't be a school that could come into the program, and they pretty much would have to do that dealing with, as Mr. Shelsky said, through this process that through the federal government, because this is piggybacking on that now. We're relying on that infrastructure sort of in place already, and just, I guess that's the best way to think of it. And you're right, Representative, in the bill you'll see on the top of the second page up there in line one, spread them geographically throughout the state, so that the director Issa would try to look and not just clump the expansion into one area. Try to let it reach out as best they can, depending on who is available and interested in the program, to spread it around out there. Because as you saw on the map, they are sprinkled around pretty well. Mm-hmm. Mr. Shelsky has something.
And there is ample precedent of programs that, as Representative Cox said, get your bang for the buck if you support a program that already has facilities director, sort of staff and infrastructure, and hire direct student workers that will then additional counselors. Those counselors can go out to the same schools, but there is a precedent where, for example, St. Scholastica has often run a satellite operation in Cook and Eveleth, where they have a staff person that really travels. And responding to the question about overlap, there is a band across sort of the northern part of the 1st Congressional District and all the way up the western edge of the 7th Congressional District where there are very few services being provided of this sort to students. And I would hope that Mankato State, for example, would look aggressively at some of those areas where they could establish an outreach program to a school that some of those rural schools actually have no high school guidance counselors at all. They have a traveling counselor that spends a half a day, half a day a week in each of a dozen schools.
Final question?
On that part, and I note that, for instance, Mankato State, Minnesota State of Mankato has got 14 schools that they're working with, mm-hmm. so clearly each site has the ability to work with, yes. depending on resources, with more than one. And in fact, they all work with more than one. But the issue really is a statewide issue, and I think that's part of what these demographic numbers tell us, that we really need to get aggressive, Mr. Chair, about getting more students into post-secondary, and that's going to require us, I think, getting into every nook and cranny into the state with either these kind of programs or similar type of programs. And there are other types that are out there. And so I guess my question, Mr. Shelsky, is are TRIO programs adaptive enough to be able to work collaboratively with other type of programs that perhaps get a bigger bang for the buck, for instance? So if the state were to provide support for other programs, could we expect, in addition to TRIO, could we expect that kind of collaboration from the TRIO model, or does the TRIO model need to be a proprietary, non-collaborative, approach?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mariani, TRIO programs already engage in significant outreach and work with neighborhood, tutoring programs. We have a conference going on today in St. Olaf. That's an open conference that people wanted to come down and learn best practices in how to reach out to these populations. We would welcome that. Additionally, the programs reach out to each other, and so we do site monitoring visits from the University of Minnesota, for example. I may go to North Hennepin, and people from Mankato University. I can't say it other than Mankato State. We're coming. Review files, look to see that indeed we are keeping the proper kinds of records. We share information broadly and widely. We share through our participation in programs like the Minnesota Minority Education Partnerships, proposed Minnesota College Access Network. We would hope to be a contributing organization, both individually at the campus level, but also statewide at the state level, to any effort of that sort.
Representative Cox, any final?
No, I think you've probably heard it all, members. It's a great program, and I hope you will consider it for inclusion in your final bill as you prepare it.
All right, Representative Cox renews his motion that House File 1047 be considered as we assemble our omnibus bill.
Thank you.
Right. Members, we will not be meeting on Monday. We'll meet on Tuesday at 9 o'clock in this room. And I'm told that maybe later this afternoon the bill we'll be considering on Tuesday will be available. If not this afternoon, it'll be tomorrow morning. Mm-hmm. Questions?
So, Mr. Chair, does that mean that you'll be forwarding a bill to committee members to review prior to the Tuesday hearing?
Mm-hmm. That would be the plan.
Okay.
Yeah, as soon as it's available.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Chairman, it will be a chairman's bill as opposed to a committee bill. There have been times when it's been done both ways, where we've actually built a bill in committee and it's been a committee bill. Long history of that that kind of an approach. But when you say the bill is ready, then it's one that you've had drafted and introduced as the committee chair. Is that
more or less? But it, I can honestly tell you that most of the things that we've talked about, you know, are in there. So it's you could call it a committee bill because it's most of the things we've talked about. And but for all practical purposes, I guess it would be the chair's bill.
Mr. Chair?
But you'll have a chance to change it on Tuesday if there's things that...
Chairman, if you've built enough good things in it, we may not want
to. Oh, I didn't want to be too boastful, but... I'm hoping it's a good one, so...
No. Yeah. Well, I appreciate your being willing to share it with us from the minority perspective prior to...
We did invite Joe to be with us yesterday as we did go over some of it, but he was at another meeting, I guess, so... He wasn't able to attend. But we did offer that he would be there to help as we discussed some of the features that are currently in the bill. Representative Cox?
And Mr. Chair, your intention then is we'll get copies and review over the weekend and then be prepared to make a committee bill on Tuesday.
That's right.
There we go. Okay.
I guess another way to look at it.
Uh-huh. All right.
Mr. Chair?
We'll be first up, you know, as we get to the floor, so we get to... Mm-hmm. On the time schedule. Yes,
just on another issue very quickly, if I may, and I haven't had a chance to visit with you about this yet, but I promise I will. You know, in recent, I know we have University of Minnesota people here, so you might want to take note here. In the last couple of weeks, we've had some pretty dramatic news from the University of Minnesota in terms of some of its restructuring. The piece that's gotten the biggest part of that has to do with the General College restructuring at the University of Minnesota. I can tell you quite honestly, I was last Thursday at Minneapolis Urban League dinner where several hundred people were in attendance. And I can't remember actually whether it was the Reverend Schefter who raised the issue or not, but as part of the program, someone mentioned the General College restructuring issue at the University of Minnesota, and they mentioned it within the context of access, and obviously since it's the Urban League Dinner, they talked about it within context of access for African-American citizens and other potential students of color. I've had some just quick discussions with some folks at the University of Minnesota, and I have a lot of confidence in President Brunick's leadership there. But I do think we would be remiss as a higher ed house body if we didn't at least have some discussions here in public about the potential impact and ramifications of that restructuring effort. And I'm not saying it's good or bad, but I think it's important for us to have some discussions here in public. And I suspect that there would be a lot of folks in the public that would like to participate in that discussion. And so what I want to offer, Mr. Chair, if it's possible, is I know we'll be past our deadlines at some point, but since that came up pretty late, and you know, most of us were not prepared for it, it might be possible for us to have an informational hearing and ask the University of Minnesota to come and share their thoughts on that and perhaps responses and reactions from others in the public. I think that would be a good investment of our time.
Representative Mariani, we're thinking on the same track. Okay. May 2nd, he will be here.
Oh, so you're hoping to schedule something?
He is scheduled, I understand, already.
Terrific, okay.
So that was quick.
Yeah. He being President Brunick.
Yes.
Great.
So I think that'll be a good opportunity again for discussion.
Super.
With that, I believe our meeting is adjourned.